two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind, until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Why, hello there. It's your old pal, Sarah Silverman, and I'm back with a brand new season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast. On my podcast, I am talking about everything. Politics? Yeah, we get into it. Favorite sandwich shop in L.A.? I know a few spots, and I'm going to tell you about them. I'm also going to be talking to you. I will be reacting and responding to listener voicemails in real time. Let me tell you, things can get weird, and I love every second of it. Weird is my comfort zone. The newest season of the Sarah Silverman Podcast is out now wherever you get your podcasts.
Lemonada.
Hey there, it's Julian Castro. I hope you and your loved ones continue to savor these last few days before the start of a new year. It's still so incredible to me to think that 2021 brought us a new administration, it brought newer methods to combat COVID, and also better opportunities to show up for communities like yours nationwide. And speaking of new beginnings, one of our most celebrated guests from season one embarked on an exciting chapter of his own this fall. Legendary newsman Dan Rather turned 90. That's right, 90 years old. In this episode, we talk about his storied career spanning 7 decades, the importance of free speech in a post-Trump era, and the joys of being one of our favorite Twitter personalities. Enjoy.
Our country has undergone quite a number of changes in the last 4 years, and journalism has changed with it.
Direct from our newsroom in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather substituting for Walter Cronkite.
And this week, I talk with Dan Rather, a legendary journalist and news anchor who has covered pretty much every event you can think of over the past 60 years.
Good evening, everyone. Various elements of the Democratic Party acknowledging an imperative need for unity.
When TV news was at the epicenter of American media, Dan was anchoring the top-rated newscast. And today, at 89, he's found a loyal following on new media platforms like Facebook and Twitter.
It's very difficult now with so many news outlets, so much disinformation, so much propaganda and lies, to make of yourself an informed news consumer.
Having accurate information is vital to so many things. Our understanding of the world, our trust in institutions, and even the policy we implement. And while digital technology has enabled us to better access and share information with the click of a button, it's also led to the proliferation of disinformation and echo chambers. It's a reality that has seemingly reached a breaking point in the past few weeks.
Mr. Trump lost his primary megaphone overnight when Twitter permanently shut down his personal account, breaking off his connection to nearly 90 million followers.
As Facebook and Twitter banned users for supporting the violent mobs at the U.S. Capitol last week, downloads surged for a less restrictive social media app called Parler.
So the president's banned from Twitter, 88 million followers, banned from Facebook, 35 million followers. Parler appears to be getting shut down. What do you make of all this?
Freedom of speech is one of the most important rights we have as Americans. But how do we reconcile the rights of private companies with the collateral effects of censorship? Dan joins us to talk about striking that balance, the power of big tech, and the lessons we can learn from journalism's past to overcome the obstacles our country is facing now. This is Our America. I'm your host, Julian Castro. Hey, Dan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you. You know, that's kind of a foggy, overcast day here in Austin, but we've had some beautiful weather, and What could be better to have a conversation with you?
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm here in San Antonio, so just down the road. I have to say, you know, I was really looking forward to this interview because I've admired you for a long time. My brother Joaquin and I think you know my brother Joaquin. We grew up watching the CBS Evening News with my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother used to tell us that when my mom was young, she had a crush on you when you were a reporter at CBS News. And Joaquin and I at one time wanted to go into broadcast journalism. When we went to Stanford, we thought we were going to become TV reporters. And, you know, that was due in no small part because we had watched you growing up. And so it's really neat to get to have a conversation. You started your career in 1950. And you've done it all. I mean, you've written for the Houston Chronicle, worked at KHOU-TV, and then, of course, you anchored the CBS Evening News for 24 years. You covered the Kennedy assassination. You covered the Vietnam War. You covered Watergate, 9/11. When you think back to your distinguished career, you know, are there one or two moments that you know you look back on most fondly that are the most poignant? You know, what are those one or two moments that you think back to?
Oh, I've had a lot of poignant moments. One of them, Julian, was when I was assigned as my very first major assignment for CBS News to cover the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and what were some of the beginnings of what we now know as the Civil Rights Movement.
Martin Luther King is among those who has vowed not to let the voter registration movement in Leesburg...
When Dr. Martin Luther King came down from Montgomery, Alabama last month to give the Albany movement impetus, he told these people that the road to integration would require unity and patience, as well as courage.
Covering Dr. King in those days, it changed me as a person, and it changed me as a pro. And as a consequence of that, it's always been one of the most poignant moments to look back on. Tiananmen Square, which is a story which is unfortunately fading from a lot of people's consciousness.
As the world watches and listens in horror, the peaceful pro-democracy demonstration in China comes to a violent and bloody end, crushed by waves of Chinese military forces. Hundreds of
when we took CBS News to Tiananmen Square and were out front in bringing that story to the world, I knew it was a big story. I knew it was one of the biggest stories I'd ever cover. Poignant, I don't know about poignant, but I think of it very often. And of course, it was 9/11. It's a rare day that goes by that in one way or the other, I don't still think about 9/11. Not so much my coverage involved in it, but just, you know, where the country was that day and how resilient we were in coming back. And I hope we can find some of that resiliency over these next months and years, because we're going to need it.
One of the things that I remember really distinctly about 9/11, I guess I was 27 years old, 26 years old. I remember that in the days after 9/11, that the country felt more united, more together than it had in a very long time. Where do you place in modern American history, from what you have seen, where do you place what happened at the Capitol on January 6th and what it says about where we are now as a country?
Well, where I place it, it's as important as anything that's happened in my lifetime. And when you ticked off, you know, the datelines and deadlines that I've covered in the past, sometimes there's a tendency to overemphasize the present because we're leading through it. Mm-hmm. But by any objective analysis, this is one of the most critical times in the country. And, you know, where it leaves us is, frankly, I'm worried. I'm an optimist by nature and by experience. And I tend to want to be positive and always like to blow on the embers of hope. And I do so now. But we have to be realistic about it. The fact that over 70 million people voted to return Donald Trump to the presidency for a second term lays out the shadow of what I think will be a challenge that's going to go pretty far into the future of how to reconcile ourselves. I'm not an expert on reconciliation, but when I think of Joe Biden's many challenges, And he, representative of us all, has some tremendous challenges. But none is greater, in fact, very few are as important as this business of we have to reconcile ourselves. Now, how we do that, I don't know. I do think it begins with each of us asking ourselves, well, can we listen to other people? People, frankly, more important, the ones that we almost violently disagree with, we need to listen to each other and see if we can find some kind of common ground. You know from your own experiences, particularly being a mayor, which is one of the toughest jobs in America, to be the mayor of a city the size of San Antonio. It's a constant effort to find common ground to say to folks, look, I know there's 100 things we disagree on. Is there really one thing here where we can get together and do something and then try to build on that? Metaphorically, I think that's where we are as a country and the people right today.
You interviewed Donald Trump for a 60 Minutes 2 piece that I think aired in early January of 2000 when he was thinking about running on the Reform Party ticket. And one of the questions that you asked him, which I thought was a brilliant, straightforward question, was,
let's talk about your values. What are your values?
Well, I think I'm a great father. I have fantastic children, 4 great children. And I believe in family. I believe in marriage. I believe in religion.
You said you value family?
I do value family. In fact, I think the biggest disappointment was that I haven't had...
But now that we've seen 4 years of Donald Trump as president and a year and a half before that of the campaign, what do you think his values are?
Honestly, I have no idea. His values are not what he stumbled around in that interview trying to allude to. His values are not what we would say classic American family values, or for that matter, the values of someone who believes deeply in our institutions of government that form our system of checks and balances. But, you know, I have no idea. I can't read Donald Trump's heart. What we can judge him on is acts. And his presidency was marked not only by chaos and confusion. I always felt he was so dysfunctional that that part of his presidency didn't get as much negative coverage and as much comment as I thought it should have. It was so chaotic and dysfunctional because so much of the rest of his administration dealt in one way or the other with, I don't know, to use an old-fashioned word, dealt with mendacity. So the combination of dysfunction, chaos, and just outright mendacity. What he did, he and those around him did with children on the border. I mean, it's a story long since gone, but it still echoes with me. And I think it echoes with a lot of people. It's absolutely unconscionable. So when you talk about what his values are, you know, I just don't know. I will say this. He is a master of the major mediums of his time. Franklin Roosevelt was a master of radio, and it got him 4 terms as president. John Kennedy was a master of television. Mm-hmm. He wrote it into the presidency. When it comes to the internet and social media, Donald Trump mastered it. He mastered that before anybody else in politics really got a handle on it. Yes, Obama took advantage of the internet beginning with his presidential run in 2008. But Donald Trump seized the whole idea of social media, which didn't exist so much during Obama's time, and used it to his advantage. This has to do with getting back to that phrase, communicable trust between the leadership and the red, that Trump managed to use social media to gather a very loyal following. Now, it was never a majority, but it got up into the 40, 42, 43%. I think we can say, thankfully, it's now down to, what, 28 or 30%. Donald Trump was good and compelling at convincing people, particularly people in the lower and middle echelons of the economic system, that he represented real change. He was good at convincing people that he had done that in his private and personal business life and that he could do it as president.
Help make them successful that way.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Look, there are a lot of people in the country that are really hurting. And if I may say so, one of the things I admired about your presidential campaign is that you tried to give voice to those people good, decent people who love their country and are aching to do something that will make things better for their kids, that sort of thing, who just have said to themselves, the system is not working for me, we have to make a change. Enter Donald Trump into that, saying, I am a very successful businessman. I recognize that you want and need dramatic change for the better, and I can deliver on that. Donald Trump, after all the things he did and didn't do, ran a chaotic and in some ways damned administration. He still got more than 70 million votes.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. After season one aired, I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. And of course, my 90-year-old mom, Judy. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me Season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
Can't get enough of your favorite Lemonada Media podcasts? By subscribing to Lemonada Premium today, you'll gain access to fun and inspiring bonus content from all of our podcasts across the Lemonada Media Network. As a subscriber, you can listen to never-before-heard interview excerpts, behind-the-scenes segments, and continue to uncover new ways to make life suck less through all of our exclusive subscriber audio. Check out a free trial of Lemonada Premium today in the Apple Podcast app by clicking on our podcast logo and then the subscribe button.
You know, you think about that today as we were talking about the feeling of the country now and how divided it often feels, especially in light of what happened on January 6th and these very real wounds and the polarization. You wrote a book called What Unites Us. As you see it, what do you think unites us? And what do we need to build on?
Well, one of the things I think unites us, and I recognize there are people who no longer believe this, but I believe that the overwhelming majority of the people of the United States are absolutely dedicated and, yes, are still willing to give up their lives to preserve this constitutional republic based on the principles of freedom and democracy that we have, that the preservation of the American dream of a free people striving ever to make a more perfect union, not that we'll ever have a perfect union, but ever striving to make it more perfect. I think overwhelmingly Americans, of every race, color, creed, religion, ideology, believe in that. It's one of the things that unites us. What I tried to do with the book, What Unites Us, is I did try to offer a few things that I think unites us, including what I've just said, and the commitment to the rule of law, a commitment to one person, one vote. But what I sought to do with the book is start a conversation. I think in a system in a country such as ours, we need to have a constant conversation of, look, we're trying something nobody else in history has ever really tried, much less succeeded, and that is hold together united a country that is multiracial, multireligious, multiethnic, with a demographic that no country in the history of the world has ever tried to do what we're trying to do. And therefore, we need to have a constant conversation of what unites us. I would also say I think one of the things that unites us is a dedication to trying to make life better for our children. I think these are among the things that unites us. But it's a difficult period, Julian. I don't want anybody to think that I'm sort of off on my own. Everything is going to be wonderful. I think we can be better. I think we can reach higher ground, but only if we really work at it and are willing to listen to one another and work with one another. Otherwise, this time of reckoning we're going through now is not going to have a very good ending.
Yeah, after the events of January 6th. And you bring up a great point, and I think a lot of people would agree with you. The first truly, you know, social media savvy president for his full term where it was in bloom the entire time was Donald Trump, especially on Twitter. Now, a lot of people would say that you've mastered social media as well because you have millions of people that follow you on Twitter and on Facebook. You once told the Columbia Journalism Review that you were convinced by others before you jumped onto Twitter and Facebook that you had to do this in order to be relevant in today's times. And so what do you make now of Twitter and Facebook cutting Donald Trump off from these two platforms that you recognized, you know, a decade or so ago, are absolutely essential, as you say, to keep you relevant, and that he certainly used to his maximum advantage as president? You know, what does it mean for him then?
Well, we'll see what it means for him. I'll be very interested to see what he decides to do, how he tries to continue his advantage on these platforms moving forward. But number one, that footnote bottom of the page is true. I was slow to come around to social media and had to be convinced to do so by my two grandsons and young members of my own staff who said, look, it's not an option. If you want to be relevant, even on the edges, even in some microscopic way, you've got to be on social media. And so I put my toe into it first, not really believing in it, and then found an audience for which I'm very grateful. But to the larger question of the social media platforms that in many ways helped create the Donald Trump that the country has come to know, in the end, right at the end, cut him off and sealed him out. I'll be candid with you, and I'd be surprised if this isn't shared by a lot of people. I'm of several minds about this. Censorship is something we need to be very, very careful of. And these are, you know, they're independent companies. This is not the government shutting somebody off. This is these two very big companies.
That's right, yeah.
So those who don't like Trump and worried about what was happening to the country applauded this. But I think we have to be very careful going forward. We need to have a national debate about this. Now, my own personal opinion, clearly labeled, is that there needs to be a kind of trust busting. There needs to be more competition, that too few companies control too much of the social media platforms. In my dreams, we would have a 21st century Teddy Roosevelt who did with these companies what Roosevelt did with the railroad monopolies and the oil monopolies and so forth. I hope I can be forgiven when I say I'm of several minds. I don't want false equivalency, but on the one hand, yes, I think they made the right move. I think they waited too late to do it. They have a lot to answer for because they didn't do it a long time ago. On the other hand, I'd be really reluctant to applaud it too enthusiastically as long as these few companies have this much power.
Well, and to your point, I think the ACLU put out a statement throwing out a cautionary note about, you know, don't celebrate too loudly because that's a lot of power that these few companies have. And I do think that part of the answer certainly is what you're talking about, more competition. We also saw, though, even in this case, I mean, there was a competitor in Parler, and then Parler got, you know, the rug pulled out from under it by Amazon Web Services.
Right. But let me turn the tables. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think they made the right move. I certainly believe that there have been instances before where Donald Trump should have been suspended. I think him personally, that his account should have been locked a long time ago. At the same time, I recognize that that is a tremendous amount of power to have. In constitutional law, I'm trying to remember back, you know, my con law from one out year, you know, people have said, for instance, hey, this doesn't really relate to the First Amendment because the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. You know, if I were arguing the other side of that, I would say, well, in some instances, there are what are called limited public forums, shopping centers that because they are so public, they basically become like a public space. In some ways, I think that Twitter and Facebook are like that. They've taken on the character of limited public forums. So all of that is to say, I do think that we have to be very careful with that power that they have. And I'm glad it seems like that with the Biden administration, we're going to have regulators who are going to perhaps try and figure this out going forward.
Well, amen. I agree.
Yeah, let's hope.
But you know, a lot of people, you mentioned regulators, their defenses go up. But I do think this is a case where some serious consideration needs to be given to some sort of at least very broad regulation. And again, I come back to breaking up the power of these very few companies.
Hi, I'm June Diane Raphael.
And I'm Jessica St. Clair.
And we would like to invite you on a hilarious and heartfelt journey each week on The Deep Dive. From navigating the chaos of motherhood and family to exploring the depths of grief and loss, we are just two best friends who process life together and with you guys. Discover our secrets to finding joy amidst the madness and get ready for unfiltered conversations about life, love, and everything in between. And nails. We talk a lot about nails. Now, community is everything to us at The Deep Dive. We believe in the power of connection and the strength that comes from supporting one another, and we would love to have you with us. So be sure to join us every Wednesday on The Deep Dive from Lemonada Media, wherever you get your podcasts.
People love to pretend that there are simple formulas for living your best life now. Eat this and you won't get sick. Manifest it and everything will work out. But there are some things you can choose and some things you can't. And it's okay that life isn't always getting better. I'm Kate Bowler, and on Everything Happens, I speak with kind, smart, funny people about life as it really is. Beautiful, terrible, and everything in between. Let's be human together. Everything Happens is available wherever you get your podcasts.
You have said many, many times that you are a journalist at heart. That's what you love to do. And it's amazing that you continue to do that and reach millions of people. Edward R. Murrow was one of your heroes, somebody that you came up looking up to.
I think there is an enormous job to be done by radio in reporting this country to itself. I think the absence of regionalism in this country is deplorable.
I think the fact he did documentaries like Harvest of Shame that brought attention to the plight of migrant farm workers, obviously covered the McCarthy hearings, sort of the godfather of TV news. What do you think that he would say about the media landscape today if he were here?
Well, first of all, I do think that he would be appalled. I think he'd be absolutely appalled to look at the media landscape today. First of all, for the very size of it. Murrow was always worried about certain media companies getting too big, but he was talking in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And I think today he would be aghast to see the widespread influence and reach of the internet. Secondly, I think he would be very much concerned that there isn't more regulation. Mm-hmm. I suspect that Murrow would say, we, the people of the United States, made a very big mistake when we didn't have some government control when cable television first began operating in the late 70s, early 1980s. That, as you know, there's been government regulation and control over the airways television, but there's been virtually none over cable television. So I think if you call it that. I think the biggest thing that concerned Murrow is such questions as, well, who is a journalist today? That there are a lot of people claiming to be journalists who are actually in the entertainment business. Some of the hardest things he had to say was about mixing entertainment values with news values. So I think he'd be very much concerned of the blurring of the lines to where sometimes you can't tell the difference between news and entertainment.
One of the biggest problems that we've seen during the last few years, especially around the 2016 election and the 2020 election, has been disinformation. The level of disinformation out there has been tremendous and has given birth to the QAnon conspiracy and a number of other things. What do you make of the level of disinformation, and what do you think that we need to do about it?
Well, first of all, I think that if you are dedicated to trying to preserve our system of government, you have to really be concerned about the tremendous success that disinformation, outright lies, and straight out propaganda, the success they've had in our country over the last few years, really stunning. What we can do about it going forward, among other things, is one, begin teaching, and I think it should be a required course for every student in the country no later than seventh grade, of how to be an intelligent consumer of news. It's very difficult now with so many news outlets, so much disinformation, so much propaganda and lies, to make of yourself an informed news consumer. So that's one thing. Included in that would be, by the way, a revival in the teaching of civics. It hasn't been that long ago that civics, such things as how does a city ordinance get passed? How does a piece of legislation get passed in Washington, were actually taught in civics classes in schools. They've mostly gone out of fashion these days. So those are two things we could do going forward. And the other, I think, is that we journalists need to suck it up, and I include myself in this, and say, you know, look, there are a lot of things we can't change, disinformation, propaganda, lies, trying to undercut the media. What we can do is do our damn jobs. What is our job? What is our mission? To get to the truth, or as close to the truth as is humanly possible, and to tell it. You know, news is not an exact science, as you know, Julian. News is a kind of crude art, even on its best days. And we're going to make mistakes. But I do think it's time for journalists to give ourselves a bit of a lecture and not say, well, this and that needs to be done by other people. What we need to do is rededicate ourselves to what we consider to be our life's work and do it the best we can. And that will help in the fight against disinformation, propaganda, and lies.
You know, American journalism has been centered in a lot of ways around this 50-50, telling both sides of the story, which has merit. But what do you do when one group seems to have gone into the ditch, as evidenced by thousands of people going to the Capitol and taking over the Capitol? How does that traditional both sides journalism work? Do you have to adjust? How do you reflect on that?
Well, I do a lot of reflecting on it. And you touch a certain nerve with me, Vivian. Because for most of my journalistic career, I was taught to, both as a student and as an apprentice, to do so-called, quote, objective journalism, which took the idea, all of us have our biases, and no one can be without biases, but insofar as it's humanly possible, to set aside your biases. In the 21st century, with the development of the internet and social media, it's very clear that this has led to an over-reliance on false equivalency. Which is to say, okay, the Democrats say one thing, give them four paragraphs. The Republicans say another thing, give them four paragraphs. And this false equivalency was one of the many things that helped lead us to Donald Trump. And realizing that, every journalist I know, and it's certainly true of myself, has had to say to themselves over the last 4 or 5 years, well, wait a minute, we need to make adjustments. There is not always two sides to every story. Sometimes there are 4 or 5 sides to a story. Look, 2 and 2 does not make 5. It makes 4. Water does not run uphill. There are certain, objective facts of things. So if somebody says water doesn't run uphill, and another person says, well, of course water runs uphill. I see it run uphill all the time. You don't give the same equivalency to those two things. I hope this is to your point. It's something we struggle with. Journalism is reforming in some ways, and one of the ways it's reforming is to be as fair as you possibly can be, get as close to the truth as you can do, and don't flinch. Before Donald Trump came into office, not very many journalists would use the word lie, even if a politician told the most bald-faced lie, even if he swore.
They wouldn't do it.
They wouldn't do it. And I was among those. Now, what changed during the Trump era was realizing that when you have a president who tells literally tens of thousands of lies, this doesn't serve the country well because it doesn't serve the truth well. to duck and dodge, that when a lie is a lie, you have to call it a lie. And there's much more of that spirit in journalism today, but we're going to be struggling with this question for quite a while of how not only to be fair, but to get to the truth and to convince people of what we're doing. I sometimes think we don't try to explain what we think we are doing. Other people have to judge how well or how poorly we're doing it. What we hope we're doing, what we think we're doing, as I say, is the mission of journalism is to get as close to the truth as is humanly possible and tell it in the fairest way, but don't go through contortions trying to twist yourself inside out, trying to gain favor with everybody.
And my last question is, you know, somewhere out there today, there's a little girl or little boy who is watching the news on TV or on the internet and is fascinated by journalism. And they know that they're going to go out and be a reporter. You've had a long and distinguished career in journalism. It's what you love. You know about the challenges of yesterday and the challenges of today and tomorrow in it. What is your advice to that young kid that has a twinkle in their eye for journalism?
Well, you're kind to ask. It's first, if it's your passion, go for it. If it's your dream, dream big, absolutely go for it. But know that it's going to be really hard to make your way. It's one of the tougher professions in which to get a start, get a handhold right at the beginning. And tough even after you get that first job to hold on and make it in journalism. But it can be a great career if you're willing to give your whole heart to it. Second thing is never lose your idealism. That in journalism, you see a kind of Dickensian side of life, an underside of life, a lot of cynicism, a lot of violence, a lot of bad things that can turn you into a cynic pretty easily. So you have to treasure your idealism, keep your idealism. Third thing is learn to write well, dedicate yourself to becoming a better writer all your life, because the bedrock of the craft is good writing. But I ended this advice as I began it by saying, if you dream it, go for it. It can happen.
Well, that's wonderful advice. And, you know, I want to thank you for joining me and thank you for continuing to use your voice to inspire so many folks. May 2021 be a better year, a more hopeful one.
Amen to that. Thank you very much, Julian. Good luck. Godspeed. Thank you for having me on.
Edward R. Murrow once wrote, "The right of dissent, or if you prefer, the right to be wrong, is surely fundamental to the existence of a democratic society." As tech companies gain more and more wealth and power, while simultaneously becoming the go-to platforms for public speech, there's perhaps never been a better time to examine the role that free speech plays in our society and how we value truth and freedom at the same time. If you'd like to submit your reflections, you can email our team at ouramerica@lemonadamedia.com. That's ouramerica@lemonadamedia.com.
Do you ever get hit with a cringy memory of your 13-year-old self out of nowhere and suddenly you're panic sweating and laughing at the same time? Don't worry. We all get that. It's because being an adolescent is one of the most visceral shared experiences we have as people. And we want to talk about it. Join me, Penn Badgley, and my two friends, Nava and Sophie, on Podcrushed as we interview celebrity guests about the joys and horrors of being a teenager and how those moments made them who they are today. New episodes of Podcrushed are out on April 24th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Elise Myers. I'm a content creator and comedian. You might know me from TikTok. Why am I in your ears right now? Well, that's a great question. I would love to tell you. I have a new podcast called Funny Because It's True. On my show, I'll be interviewing comedians, pop culture icons, and also just people I find really funny. We'll be talking about the awkward moments that keep you awake at night. Because if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay, Funny Because It's True. Out now wherever you get your podcasts.